You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, Wisconsin-based photographer Pete Souza shares some stories from his new book of photography based on his years as the White House photographer. Now the United States has aided Ukraine with billions of dollars in aid since Russia first invaded the European country this past February. According to polls, most Americans are in favor of Ukraine winning and majorities support U.S. aid. But that support isn't universal. And Ukrainian leaders have expressed concern that the midterm elections in the U.S. could lead to a cut in support. Some Republican candidates and leaders, including House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, have criticized the scale of aid. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the U.S. should continue aiding Ukraine? Do you think the U.S. has already given enough? Will you vote in part based on attitudes toward Ukraine? What questions do you have about the latest there and the impact of the U.S. elections? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. John Reuter is an associate professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
John, looking back, how important has U.S. aid, both military and economic, been for Ukraine and its ability to sustain its war effort to fend off this Russian invasion?
Oh, it's been crucial because the big disadvantage that the Ukrainians faced from the outset of the war was in materiel. The Russians had a lot more advanced weapons and a lot more of them. And so Western military aid was crucial for tipping that balance back in Ukraine's favor. And so, you know, in recent weeks, Ukraine has made a lot of progress on the battlefield, its first real major progress since March and April. They staged a successful counteroffensive in the Kharkiv region and retook a bunch of territory. And I think that would have been impossible without Western military aid.
What are you seeing when it comes to concerns from Ukrainian leaders and from Western European leaders when it comes to the future of U.S. aid for Ukraine?
Yeah, I think a lot of European leaders, well, and also, of course, Ukrainian leaders have been alarmed at some of the rumblings in the United States about wavering support for continued aid. And those signs have come from both ends of the political spectrum, funnily enough. So there was a letter from the Progressive Caucus or some of the Progressive Caucus House Democratic Caucus that went out a few days ago and urged the Biden administration to try to enter in negotiations with Russia. On the right, among Republicans, there's been some statements by Kevin McCarthy that maybe if the Republicans win in the midterms, that they might not be willing to use his phrase, not be willing to write a blank check for continued aid to Ukraine. And the concern, the big concern for Ukrainian leaders and European leaders is not just that the U.S. might start sending less aid, but that the U.S. is such a leader on this issue that if the U.S. starts to blink in its support for Ukraine and in sending aid to Ukraine, then that might be a signal to other European countries, and then they might follow suit, and that the coalition of support for aiding Ukraine might start to unravel.
Let's look at the Republican and Democratic statements you just mentioned in turn. Starting with Republicans, you mentioned the no blank check comment from Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. Now, we haven't had an election yet. We don't know what the outcome is going to be. One possibility is that Republicans control one or both houses of Congress, giving them the power to block funding potentially by threatening a government shutdown or by other means. But that's McCarthy. We've seen some Republican candidates criticize support from Ukraine. On the other hand, we're hearing from Senate current Minority Leader Mitch McConnell saying we're standing with Ukraine here. Former Vice President, likely presidential candidate Mike Pence saying Republicans should stick with Ukraine. What are you looking at when it comes to that debate within the Republican Party?
Yeah, that's right. And I think practically speaking, it's highly unlikely that funding levels for Ukraine are going to change, or the commitment to continuing military aid to Ukraine is going to change dramatically after the election for two main reasons. First, as you mentioned, there's still a large chunk of the Republican Party that is committed to standing up to Russia and aiding Ukraine. And second, and I think this is maybe less appreciated in the media these days, is that there's a lot of money that's already been approved that's still in the pipeline, that's still being distributed. So even in no new funds are approved in the fall or the spring, it's going to be quite a while before what's already been approved is spent down.
We're talking to John Reuter from UW-Milwaukee, looking at the Russian invasion of Ukraine and American politics and the impact that the midterm elections may or may not have on continued U.S. aid for Ukraine. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Okay, we've got that letter you mentioned. 30 House Democrats had signed on to this apparently three, four months ago. It expressed support from Ukraine and for the military support from the U.S. and then says, I'm going to quote here, "We urge you to pair the military and economic support the United States has provided to Ukraine with a proactive diplomatic push, redoubling efforts to seek a realistic framework for a ceasefire." Ending the quote there. It's a lot longer than that. And that seems to be the tricky bit. How much can the U.S. step in and enter direct negotiations without Ukraine taking the lead?
Yeah, I mean, the White House, their official position all along has been that it's not for the U.S. or any other European power to decide when to start negotiation, that's Ukraine's decision. But at the same time, I think it would be naive to think that the U.S., that their opinion on whether negotiations should start doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. They hold a lot of cards here. Right now, I think it's the opinion of the Biden administration that the most prudent thing to do is to try to give maximal support to Ukraine so that they can keep up this success on the battlefield. They've been relatively successful in the past few months, and so it doesn't make sense to start negotiations right now. And so, I'm not privy to the internal details, but I think there was a lot of people who were angry in the Biden administration and also among other congressional Democrats about this letter, because it seemed to come at an inopportune time. And there was also concern that, the Russians would be heartened by this, that they would be emboldened by this, that they would feel like their strategy of dragging the war out until the Western coalition in support of Ukraine started to crumble was vindicated.
And I should mention those members of Congress unsent that letter, I guess, or withdrew their support from the letter soon afterward. Now, I wanted to talk about that, what may be a strategy from Putin and the Russian leaders, that if they can hold on and wait things out, Western support will crumble. And we've seen things like, we've got a new coalition government in Italy where the leader says, hey, we're still behind Ukraine, we're going to still contribute stuff. And then Silvio Berlusconi, former leader, prime minister of Italy, privately saying he blames Ukraine for the war, bragging about the vodka he got for his birthday from Putin. Right. How do you think that this is really what Putin is hoping for, that we're going to see these elections change the level of support for Ukraine?
Well, yeah, I think it's not just these elections, but I think their general strategy is to try to hold their position on the battlefield until Western support starts to waver. So going back to your initial question, Rob, since that Western military support for Ukraine is so crucial, that's the trump card that Ukraine has right now, is continuing to get this support. And so Russia has announced what they call partial mobilization. It's the draft, and they're calling up more servicemen and women. But that takes time to train up those new soldiers and get them ready for the battlefield. And so I think Putin's longer term strategy is to call up more soldiers and in the meantime, hope that Western support starts to waver.
We're talking to John Reuter, associate professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee, about U.S. support and funding for Ukraine. what might be at stake during the midterm elections here in the U.S. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does foreign policy matter for you? Does support for Ukraine matter to you when deciding who to vote for? Are you supporting political candidates that do or do not want to continue funding Ukraine? What do you want to see the U.S. policy look like dealing with the Russian invasion of Ukraine? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with John Reuter, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee, joining us to talk about the war in Ukraine and how the midterm elections might affect how much money and military supplies the U.S. sends to Ukraine. By the way, you can learn more in the new Frontline documentary, Putin's Attack on Ukraine, documenting war crimes. The next airing is tonight at 11 p.m. There's more to come. Find more info at pbswisconsin.org. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support the U.S. support of Ukraine? Do you want to see more of it? Do you think we've done enough? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. John, let's talk about the idea of negotiations. It seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, Putin is very likely to want to keep some of the parts, at least of Ukraine, that he has taken over. And that seems like it would be a non-starter for Ukraine, which understandably wouldn't want to give up their territory. It seems like hard to find a starting point.
Yeah, I think that's right. But it's especially hard to find a starting point right now when the battlefield situation is in flux. I mean, so a few months ago, Russia was on the offensive and taking more territory, so they had no incentive to engage in negotiations. And now the shoe's on the other foot and Ukraine is gaining territory, so they don't have an incentive. So we're not going to see, I don't think, negotiations here until there's a real battlefield stalemate and both sides have exhausted their possibilities for finding new ways to prosecute the war in a more escalatory fashion.
Now, among the many difficulties here is this is a war being fought completely on Ukrainian soil. Ukraine is not going to invade Russia, I think. Nobody wants them to. Invading Russia, difficult under any circumstances. It seems like that might make it possible for Russia to sustain a war effort in the event of a stalemate for potentially a really long time.
Yeah, that's a really scary and depressing aspect of this war is that... it's increasingly seems like it may be in Russia's interest to drag the war out because as we were talking about earlier, what is really keeping Ukraine in the war is Western military support. And so if you think, you know, maybe 2 years down the road, the Russians are thinking maybe, well, maybe if Trump or a Republican wins those elections, then maybe really, you know, U.S. support for Ukraine will really decrease. And there'll be someone in the White House who is more open to the idea of dealing with Russia and entering into negotiations where Ukraine ends up, you know, making significant concessions.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Brookfield. John, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just think it's absolute foolishness not to continue to fund the Ukrainians. They're winning the war. Why would you walk away from the ability to degrade Russia's ability to bring war to the world, and especially with the horrendous way that they've conducted things? It's just ridiculous. And anybody that in Congress that votes to defund Ukraine, as far as I'm concerned, they're acting against the interests of the United States and the world peace.
John, thanks for that call. I've seen a couple things there, John Reuter, that this is in some ways an inexpensive investment from the United States to contain Russian aggression by stopping them at the Ukrainian border as much as possible. That stops whatever the next threat they might pose, say, to the Baltic states.
Yeah, I mean, that's the old, you know, strategy of containment or very similar to the old strategy of containment from the Cold War. And but on the point about it being inexpensive, I mean, first I'll say I agree with the caller, but just so that we have something interesting to talk about here, on the point of it being inexpensive, the U.S. has actually contributed quite a lot to in terms of aid to Ukraine. $27 billion is the latest figure. It's not insignificant. And McCarthy's comment about how they weren't going to continue writing a blank check after the election if they won, that was actually in the context of a comment about how we might be going into recession. Mm-hmm. So, his point, I think, was, well, if we're going to be drawing down spending because we're going into a recession, we're, you know, this might be one of the things that's on the chopping block.
Sure. And John, thanks for that call. And also he brought up, John, the way that Russia is conducting the war. I mentioned that Frontline documentary, concern about war crimes, targeting of civilians. What are we seeing there?
Yeah, I mean, it's this is a very violent and bloody war, and there's going to be war crimes in any conflict like that, and this one's no exception. But I do think it's asymmetrical. I think Russia, there's ample evidence that Russia is committing a lot more war crimes in this conflict than Ukraine is. And I mean, if for no other reason than like you said, this war is being carried out on Ukrainian territory, and there are civilians living there, and civilians get caught in the crossfire. Sometimes they're intentionally targeted for a variety of reasons, and yeah, so it's a very sad outcome.
Let's go back to our callers. Glenn is with us now in Northern Illinois. Glenn, hi.
Hi.
What
is it? Just a couple of comments. We certainly definitely need to keep financially supporting Ukraine as best we can. And I think also part of Putin's strategy deploying the 300,000 new troops is to hold on to and retain land that
Glenn, I think I got your point. You're breaking up a little there. I don't know if you're able to make that out over the line, but Glenn saying Putin's strategy with this big draft, this big call up of troops is to hold the territory he's got and prolong the war by throwing more of these reservists and other people he's called up over the last couple of months.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely accurate. I mean, it seems paradoxical that Russia would be the party in this conflict that's having a manpower shortage, given the fact that Russia's population is three times larger than Ukraine's. But we have to remember that early in the war, Ukraine, they implemented general mobilization. So all able-bodied men over a certain age were called up and required to enlist. And Russia, early in the conflict, was trying to insulate its population from this conflict. They didn't want Russians to view this as a war. It was called a special military operation. They didn't want the Russian population to feel the impact of this war. So they were trying everything they could to keep conscripts out of the war. Russia also has military conscription. Every male has to serve, but they only serve, you know, a year or two. And Russia was trying to not have its conscripts fight. They were trying to prosecute the war only using professional soldiers and contract soldiers and private military companies. But now Russia finds itself in the unfortunate for them situation where they're outnumbered in many instances on the back battlefield. And so they have to get more soldiers onto the battlefield if they're going to hold this territory. And that's what explains this partial mobilization.
Thanks for that call, Glenn. Jeff joins us now in Dousman. Jeff, hi.
Yeah, hi. I agree with John, early caller, and I also think it's important we stand up to Russian aggression. I feel that NATO kind of dropped the ball by allowing him to attack and not stopping it at the border.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. John, the idea of a NATO direct intervention in the war has been, it seems like, a non-starter here so far.
Yeah, it has been a non-starter. And the reason for that is quite simply that Russia is the world's largest nuclear power. They have more nuclear warheads even than the United States. And so the downside risk of some type of direct military confrontation with Russia that could escalate into an accidental or intentional nuclear exchange is so great, even if it's an insignificant chance, that those consequences would be so grave that, you know, policymakers in Washington and Europe have been very careful to avoid any sort of direct confrontation with Russia. And I think that's the right thing to do.
Thanks for that call. On a related note, John, Russia has made claims that Ukraine would unleash not a nuclear weapon, but a dirty bomb, a conventional bomb with radioactive material attached to it. Ukraine saying this is Russian propaganda. Maybe they're setting up a false flag where they're going to do something like that. A lot of uncertainty here. How do you try to sort out these claims?
This is a very muddy situation to me as well. I can't understand fully what either the Ukrainians or the Russians would get militarily mm-hmm. out of using a dirty bomb. So these dirty bombs, they don't have much battlefield effectiveness, and they would only irradiate an area of maybe even a few hundred square meters. And so they're not particularly effective. So I think what this is, it's part of the information war going on where Russia is trying to delegitimize Ukraine and make the West. This is part of their campaign, I think, to unravel Western support, to make them realize how messy and potentially catastrophic this conflict could be. It's part of their effort to convince the West that of how messy things could get, and that it might be a good idea to wind this conflict down.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
That's John Reuter, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. He joined us for a look at the midterm elections and how they might affect U.S. aid to Ukraine. Again, check out PBS Wisconsin for one current and an upcoming Frontline special on the war in Ukraine. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, it's a great time to cook some chili with cooler weather. You can make yours even better, get some great cooking advice, maybe even win a cook-off. Or just impress your friends. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we learn about the new Checkout Wisconsin State Parks program, which lets library users check out state park day passes. Now, most of us know what the American presidency is, but most of us don't have an intimate understanding of what's required to make the presidency function. Former White House photographer Pete Souza was there in the presidential bubble. He had a stint in the Reagan administration and a long run in the Obama White House. Pete is now a freelance photographer and speaker based in Madison. He's the best-selling author of the books Obama, An Intimate Portrait, and Shade, A Tale of Two Presidents. For 8 years during the Obama administration, he was chief official White House photographer and director of the White House Photo Office. His newest book is called The West Wing and Beyond, What I Saw Inside the Presidency. Pete, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, you were a White House staff photographer during the Reagan administration, and you write in the new book, you took a lot of pictures of the president, but you didn't take pictures of the presidency. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's a lot of things that happen inside the presidential bubble besides just the president of the United States. There's a lot of people that help make the presidency work. And then also just watching things out of the corner of my eye, I was more observant, I think, during the Obama administration about what was happening just sort of away from the main action.
So what kind of story are you hoping people take away from going through the books, the book and the photos in it, again, not directed at the president?
I want to introduce people to some of the rooms in the White House and the West Wing. I think people are really fascinated by the old show, The West Wing, which I don't think accurately depicts what the West Wing really looks like. But also what it was like traveling with the presidential bubble. I mean, the logistics of being in the motorcade, being aboard the Air Force One, being aboard the helicopters, what that was all like, what people would, you know, different than probably the way they imagine it. And I'm trying to peek behind the curtain, if you will, a little bit and show them you know, what I saw.
I wanted to ask you about that in particular. If people know what the White House looks like based on watching a show like West Wing, how does the reality differ from what they have seen on the screen?
Well, the reality is most of the offices in the West Wing are small. There are no windows. You can sometimes hear rats in the ceiling. the hallways are quite narrow. It's, you know, we know the Oval Office is a majestic office and the cabinet room, but the places where the people actually do the work are these small, compact offices. My office was the old White House barbershop. The White House barber, Milton Pitts, retired in the early 90s, and they didn't replace him. And so that became the photography office. The mirrors are still there, too. If you want to come by and get a haircut by the photographer, I wouldn't recommend it, though.
Now, something I'm really curious about is, you know, you're the photographer. You're taking pictures of the people and the events and things like that. What kind of security do you go through not to get in? Because that's a big rigmarole. You're right about that. But, like, do people have to review all of your photos to say, oh, no, wait, we see an edge of a document that people aren't supposed to see?
So I had a top secret SCI clearance, which we've been hearing a lot about with the classified documents at Mar-a-Lago. And the only time that would usually come into play is if we were in the Situation Room, because a lot of the documents that were out on the table would be that top secret SCI. And so if there was a case where anything was visible in terms of paperwork, I would show that to somebody on the national security staff before, you know, we would ever consider making it public.
Talking to Pete Souza, former White House photographer. His new book is The West Wing and Beyond, What I Saw Inside the Presidency. You mentioned that Situation Room. You saw it during the Reagan years in the 80s and then again in the Obama presidency. You say that was the White House room you worked in that changed by far the most.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, during the Reagan administration, there was one conference room. It was very small. I couldn't even walk around behind the chairs in the Situation Room. There was just no room. And now it's become three conference rooms, the huge space for the director of the Situation Room, and then also these rows where personnel monitor incoming traffic from around the world 24/7. So it's a big complex. And my understanding is it's under reconstruction again during the Biden administration.
One of my favorite things in the book is you have some pairs of pictures where you have your shot of, you know, inside Air Force One or in this by this particular window, and you compare it with one of your predecessors 40 years ago, 60 years ago, whatever. What was it like going through and comparing and contrasting with their work?
Well, I mean, you know, there's a lot of similarities, but the planes had changed. During the Obama administration, we had the 747. I found some pictures from the Johnson administration, much smaller plane, people still trying to, you know, find a place to take a nap during a long trip. But one of the pictures in the book is of Lady Bird Johnson's press secretary, Liz Carpenter, asleep on this little chair. And on the front of the table are packs of cigarettes and juicy fruit gum, which I found fascinating because that's back in the day when you could smoke on planes.
Now, part of your mission, as you said earlier, was to show all the people, not household names in many cases, that make this whole thing work. Can you share a couple of those, you know, people we don't see on TV? They're not the cabinet members, but who make things function here.
You know, there's every president gets assigned two Oval Office valets, and they attend to his every need. If a guest is coming in, they serve water, Coke, or whatever. And they're also... They have a tiny little kitchen, and they cook the president lunch every day. And they're ever present when the president is in the West Wing. They are always there. There's Dale Haney, who was just actually this week commemorated on his 50th anniversary as a groundskeeper at the White House. And, you know, I knew Dale during the Reagan administration. He's the one who makes sure the Rose Garden looks beautiful, who prepares the South Lawn when there's any kind of a big event. You never really hear about them, although you did this week just because he celebrated his 50th anniversary. So there's two right there I can mention.
Now, in the White House, people knew who you were and you had the access you were supposed to have. when you hit the road in foreign countries, diplomatic events, that wasn't always the case. How hard was it to get where you needed to be to take these pictures sometimes?
Yeah, that was sometimes a challenge. It was amusing to President Obama because he would kind of laugh when foreign security would try to hold me back. But I learned a few tricks along the way, and one of them was if he's walking into a room right at the last minute, I'd walk like right beside him. And if somebody tried to stop me, President Obama would just go, well, he's with me. And that's kind of settled it.
Now, you've been taking pictures in the White House. Most people won't get that opportunity. Do you have some thoughts, though, on how people can capture moments with their cameras or their phones these days that might be off the beaten path, that might be something more memorable than our standard selfies?
Well, I mean, I think the thing I always tell people is you don't always have to just stand up. You can kneel down or you can even stand on a curb or something. So change your angle of view, you know, especially with little kids. Don't be standing up if you're taking pictures of little kids. Get down at their eye level. And then really also pay attention to the light. Sometimes changing your angle just a little bit so you're not getting a big shadow on somebody's face can make all the difference in the world between an okay picture and a much better picture.
Pete, thanks so much for joining us today.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
That's Pete Souza, now a Madison-based photographer. During the Obama administration, he was chief official White House photographer. We talked to him about his latest book. It's called The West Wing and Beyond, What I Saw Inside the Presidency. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about Prohibition.
Wisconsin is known for producing a lot of products like cheese, milk, and beer. It's the state's history with the beer industry that made one listener wonder, what happened to Wisconsin's breweries during Prohibition? She reached out to WPR's Wisconsin to find out. Kelly Donovan has the answer.
When the 18th Amendment was passed in 1919, it prohibited the manufacturing, transportation, and sale of intoxicating beverages. But it did not make the possession or consumption of alcohol illegal. The purpose was to decrease the amount of drinking. According to PBS, by the 1850s, the average person in America drank about 7 gallons of alcohol a year. That's about 3 times more than Americans today. This culture of drinking continued up until Prohibition was enacted. Liz Shea of Cross Plains, Wisconsin, became curious about Prohibition after a visit to Potosi Brewing Company, founded in 1852. She couldn't shake her curiosity, so she reached out to Wisconsin to learn more about how breweries operated during the 1920s.
But I was surprised to hear that I don't think they actually shut down during Prohibition. They just sort of like switched to maybe like a similar product.
Potosi Brewery remained open during Prohibition and switched from producing beer to making non-alcoholic beer. They also started bottling milk that they made on the company's farm in Potosi. Ben Barbera is the director of collections and exhibitions at the Milwaukee County Historical Society. He says some breweries attempted to make what is called near beer. That's the product of making regular beer and then boiling the alcohol out of it.
But it wasn't a particularly successful product.
A lot of customers just didn't like the near beer. So in an effort to stay afloat and make some profit, Barbera says major breweries switched to making other, more profitable products like chocolate bars, chewing gum, processed cheese products, and even snowplows. Breweries also found ways to help customers access alcohol. Historian Jim Drager says some companies switched to malt products to make illegal home brewing possible.
It was not illegal to produce wort. Wort is the cooked down mash of grain that you add yeast to and turn it into alcohol. And it typically came with a caution that said, don't add yeast to this and don't put it in a 50-degree temperature space because it will produce alcohol and that's illegal.
Drager says prior to Prohibition, brewing was the fourth largest industry in Milwaukee. Thousands of people lost their jobs because of Prohibition. And Prohibition didn't just impact local jobs and the economy, but it impacted the culture of people who came to Wisconsin from European countries as well. John Harry is the executive director of the Portage County Historical Society. He argues that Prohibition was an ethnic war on immigrants, mainly from Germany, Ireland, Poland, and Italy. saloons were regular hotspots for working-class men at the end of a long day and also a place to socialize.
So it wasn't just a party necessarily all the time. It was more of a communal thing that they would do.
Barbera of the Milwaukee County Historical Society says Yankees, who were typically of higher class and Protestant, began demonizing alcohol and viewed drinking as a habit of the lower class.
But, you know, the same people who wanted to limit immigration saw this as a vehicle for sort of enforcing Americanization, acculturation.
After the 21st Amendment ended federal prohibition in 1933, Wisconsin quickly worked to reinstate liquor laws so breweries could once again do what they do best, make beer.
Callie Donovan is a student at UW-Milwaukee and brought us that story on prohibition. And the story idea came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a new program lets library users check out day passes to Wisconsin State Parks. We'll find out where it's happening and how it works. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, starting November 1st, 20 libraries around the state will let library users check out day passes to state parks. The pilot program called Check Out Wisconsin State Parks aims to make the parks more accessible and get more people outside. Missy Van Landen is the Recreation Partnerships Section Chief for the Wisconsin State Parks System. Missy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us how this got started and the inspiration for it?
Well, this actually got started, I'll give all the credit to the director of the Mercer Library, and she approached the DNR with this concept earlier this summer. And we thought it was a great idea and we just wanted to really run with it. So it actually came out of the library system and it was something that we've been thinking about for years, but we're finally able to make it happen.
Now, for now, this program is limited to 20 libraries across the state. Pretty good variety there. For people at participating libraries, how does this work?
Well, what they need to do is go into their participating library, and for most of them, they'll either get their information right at the checkout desk, or some of them may even see a display where they would grab a card that has a barcode similar to what you would see on the back of your book, and they bring that up to the library desk, and then the patrons that are participating get a really great amount of information, all kinds of different park information, extra bookmarks and stickers and all that kind of stuff about state parks. And then they get a day admission pass for a day of their choosing.
And this is a pilot program. How did you go about selecting the rest of the libraries that were going to join in here?
Well, we really wanted a wide variety of libraries from across the state. So we started with some community and county demographic information from the Department of Public Instruction. They're a key partner in this, another state agency. A lot of that was based on different poverty levels, participation in free and reduced lunch, elements such as no or low health insurance rates, and things like that. And so we really wanted to select communities that where this would bring an equitable opportunity to experience the natural resources in our state parks across the state. From there, we looked at communities that had both more urban and rural opportunities. And then we looked at some larger library systems and smaller library systems. And then we also looked at the geography of the state and tried to spread them out across the state. So really looking at this being a true pilot program with a variety of libraries across the state.
And let's talk about the goal a little bit. It sounds like you're hoping to get people who might think, you know, parks aren't for them to give it a try.
Absolutely. I mean, I think a marriage between the state park system and our public libraries is really natural. So what we were looking for is for community support and community involvement for people in these areas where the libraries are. We want people to come out and experience state parks and public lands, but we also want people to go to their public library as well. And so what we're hoping for is that people who've maybe never gone to a state park or forest or recreation area, or who also maybe don't frequent their libraries, that they have two new, at least one, if not two new experiences by doing this library pilot project. And so we also want to break down the barriers for people to do outdoor recreation and experience our public lands by providing the passes for free.
Talking to Missy Van Landit, Recreation Partnerships Section Chief for the Wisconsin State Parks System, looking at this Check Out Wisconsin State Parks program where people at selected libraries can get a day pass. They can check out, borrow a day pass to a state park or to the state park system for that matter. Missy, this is a pilot program going through March. When it comes to be March, how are you going to measure whether or not this is a success?
A lot of it really depends on partnerships. And I think one thing we can't take credit for is we actually did not, the DNR did not pay for the passes. We paid for all the supplemental material, but we did have two primary donors, the Nicolet Federated Library System and the Southwest Library System. And they are the ones who purchased the passes. And then the DNR supplemented with all of the material that goes along with that. And then Department of Public Instruction did the distribution. So it was really a collaborative effort. And the long-term success of this, one, depends on what kind of tweaks we may need to make if when we get through the pilot, but also it's going to depend on partnerships and future donations as well. So one interesting thing as part of the Parks program is that by statute, we can actually not give away passes. So if you get a park pass as a Christmas gift from someone at the state, they actually did buy it and not just get it from the state. So that's interesting. But we're just really looking for continuous partners and grants and other funding opportunities to make this go forward.
If there's somebody out there listening who works at or with a library and thinking, yeah, we'd love to have this here, is there a chance that in the future this could be broadened out to more libraries?
Absolutely. We're already working on a phase two, which we're hoping to launch later this winter. And we're certainly going to be planning for future phases. I've been contacted by at least a dozen other libraries that were not included in the pilot as having interest. Some of them have indicated that they're willing to purchase the passes if we'll provide the supplemental information that goes out to patrons. We've had also other state park friends groups across the state that have been interested in purchasing the passes to give away, and other library friends groups as well.
Where can people find more info about Check Out Wisconsin State Parks, in part to see if their local library is on board?
They can go to the DNR webpage, which is dnr.wi.gov, and they can click on our Out We Go page, which is O-U-T-W-I-G-O in the search menu. And there's all the information about the library page. There's also information about parks, where you can find parks, what you can do with them. And by the first, we'll actually have a map posted on that page that shows the 20 locations of the libraries and the properties that are within a 1 hour distance of those libraries.
And now, Missy, I know sometimes I'm a fair weather fan of the parks. I do get out in the winter sometimes. Is the hope here, since this is starting November, not just to get people to go to the parks period, but also to check out what they have to offer in our colder months in Wisconsin?
Absolutely. There is so much to do at Wisconsin State Parks in the winter. We do a ton of first day hikes on January 1st. We also do our friends groups help co-sponsor candlelight hikes and skis throughout the winter. We also have a ton of rental equipment like snowshoes and skis that's available from our parks. And we have groomed fat bike trails, snowshoeing, cross-country skiing, snowmobiling, sledding, you name it. So we're really hoping that people get outside and enjoy the colder months.
Missy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Been talking to Missy Van Landit, Recreation Partnerships Section Chief for the Wisconsin State Parks System. She talked to us about the Check Out Wisconsin State Parks program, a collaboration with libraries around the state that starts on November 1st. Again, you could check out information on the DNR website to find out if your local library is involved in this. And if you have a favorite thing to do in a Wisconsin state park or forest or recreation area in the winter, we want to hear about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, there's a lot of political comedy out there. Some of it's on the left. A growing amount is coming from the right. We'll talk to the author of the new book, That's Not Funny, How the Right Makes Comedy Work for Them. Plus, a new report says Wisconsin hasn't taken good care of its environment over the last decade, and that can put public health at risk. We'll talk to the author, and you can join in the conversation. Plus, we'll look at the election and election law issues at stake in the midterm elections, what it's going to mean for the future of how we vote in Wisconsin and beyond. That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.